tell a little story, a little clarification here. When I make some of these references to different things, like different times in sobriety and things like that, I don't want anyone to take offense to it, okay? Because I'm just sharing with you my experience, okay? And there were certain things, like I remember when I was about 5 years sober, I was sitting in a meeting in Concord, at the Concord Fellowship in Concord, California, which is where I got sober. And this old timer, who at the time had about 30 years, his name was Buster. And Buster used to, and for a good reason, and you know, he used to like to very subtly make his points. And so I remember I was sitting there one day, and I was one of those guys. I know y'all find this hard to believe, but I was one of those guys that used to like to hear myself talk a lot. You know what I mean? And I couldn't wait to go to a meeting and wait for somebody to say something I didn't agree with so I could sit there and blast him in a meeting, you know, because I was a really spiritual guy at 5 years of sobriety, you know. And I remember after the meeting one day, Buster said, he said, you know, whenever I have a problem, I always ask someone with 5 years of sobriety. And I said, well, why is that? He said, because guys with 5 years of sobriety know everything, right? And I thought, gee, I wonder who he's talking about, you know. Back on page 35 in the big book. Yeah. So if you have 5 years of sobriety and you know everything, keep coming back. it's amazing to me too. The longer I'm sober, how each year I know less, you know? It really is true, you know? There were so many things I was so sure about at 5 years sober or 10 years sober that, you know, I don't have the answers. You know what? It's okay for me not to have the answers. And if you ask me a question and I don't know the answer, you know, I was one of those guys. I don't know about any of you, but I will talk about stuff I know nothing about. You know what I mean? I mean, we could be having a conversation about brain surgery, and I'm going to throw in my 2 cents about brain surgery. You know what I mean? That's just how I am. And somehow over time, I don't have to do that. I don't have to do that. I'm okay not knowing. Not knowing is okay with me today. All right. Middle of page 35. We're going to start talking about a guy named Jim. He's going to give us two examples. The second one's a guy named Fred. The first one's a guy named Jim. And Jim is a low-bottom case. Fred's more of a high-bottom case. They wanted to give us one of each, I believe. I believe they did that on purpose. And remember, they're going to talk about some of the mental states that precede a relapse into drinking. The mental states, the insanity, the lie that happens just before I take the first drink. Incidentally, for those of you who are kind of history buffs in here, Jim's real name was Ralph Furlong, okay? And his original story was called Another Prodigal Story in the first edition of the Big Book, okay? He got sober in July of 1938, okay? And it says, our first example is a friend we shall call Jim. This man has a charming wife and family. He inherited a lucrative automobile agency. He has a commendable World War record. He is a good salesman. Everybody likes him. He's an intelligent man, normal so far as we could see, except for a nervous disposition. And that's very common of alcoholics. We're a little twitchy. You know what I mean? We're a little twitchy. It said he did no drinking until he was 35, and in a few years, everybody circle that. In a few years, that's, okay, so what's a few? More than one, less than five. So in 3 or 4 years, he became so violent when intoxicated he had to be committed. And the reason I share that in a few years is for you young people out there, and I was young, I was in my early 20s when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous the last time, okay? It does not take a long time to become a real alcoholic, okay? You don't have to drink for 30 years to become a real alcoholic. This man had only been drinking a few years, 3 or 4 years, and he was the real McCoy. It says, on leaving the asylum, and I wrote right there in my book, the treatment center, okay? Because back in those days, they used to send him to asylums. Nowadays, they send him to treatment centers. It means the same thing, right? On leaving the treatment center, he came into contact with us. Now, listen to what they tell him. I think this is very interesting, okay? Because we're going to see the same couple, they're going to do a couple of the same things when we get to the example of Fred. And I call this right here at the bottom of page 35, the prelude to sponsorship. A prelude to sponsorship. And the reason I call it that is because it's going to show us what they did with a brand new guy in the hospital, right? So let's see what they did. Let's see what they told him. It says, we told him what we knew of alcoholism. Okay? The illness of alcoholism. Well, what did they know about alcoholism? They knew about the allergy and the obsession, didn't they? So that's what they told him. They told him about this allergy and obsession that they got from Dr. Silkworth. And the answer we had found. They told him about step two, the idea of a spiritual, a power greater than themselves, restoring them to sanity, the idea of a spiritual experience. He made a beginning. He took step three. You'll have to trust me on that. We'll come back to that when we get to chapter five. He made a beginning. Step three. His family was reassembled, and he began to work as a salesman for the business he had lost through drinking. All went well for a time. So things started getting better, didn't they? Right? He stops drinking. He takes the first three steps. Things are going well, right? And as I said in the first hour, right, one of the negative things that happens is sometimes things start getting good, don't they? Right? And that's one of the reasons that I push the guys that I sponsor through the steps, okay? Because let me tell you something, it's much easier to take a guy through the steps who's got a week sober and he's still coming off that last run than a guy who's got, you know, a month of good night's sleep and hot meals in his stomach, right? If he's lucky, he's back in the bedroom. You know what I'm saying? It says, all went well for a time, but he failed to enlarge on his spiritual life. He didn't do 4 through 9. He didn't work with other people. He didn't take the action. And let's see what it says. It says, to his consternation, he found himself drunk half a dozen times in rapid succession. 6 times he got drunk in rapid succession. Why? Because he made a beginning, but he failed to enlarge on his spiritual life by taking action. Right? It says, now listen to this. On each of these occasions, we worked with him. Everybody underline that. They didn't say, Jim, you're not serious. Jim, call us when you're ready, right? And sometimes we say that, don't we? Right? Oh, well, when they're ready, they'll call, right? That's not what they did. It says, on each of these occasions, we work with them, right? And I think we have to have sympathy for relapsers. I really do, you know? Because remember what we found out over on the bottom of page 34. We have the utter inability to leave it alone, no matter how great the necessity or the wish. Some of these people are not drinking because they want to, right? They're drinking because they have to. That was my case when I came in here. And thank God nobody threw me out of AA, right? They said, keep coming back, right? Keep coming back. And I kept coming back. I didn't know why, but I kept coming back. It says, we worked with him reviewing carefully what had happened. He agreed he was a real alcoholic and in serious condition. So he knew, he took step one, right? That's step one right there. He knew he was an alcoholic. He knew he was in serious condition. He knew he faced another trip to the asylum if he kept on. Moreover, he would lose his family for whom he had a deep affection. So he knew the consequences, didn't he? Yet he got drunk again. So he's now slipped 7 times, right? This is the 7th drunk. It says, we asked him to tell us exactly how it happened. This is his story. Now, let's see, as we read through his story, if we can see where Jim goes from the truth and believes a lie, or goes from sane to insane thinking. Okay? It says, I came to work on Tuesday morning. What happened to Monday morning? Right? Anybody ever wonder that? See, alcoholics are bad about Mondays and Fridays. We really are, I'm telling you. It says, I remember I felt irritated that I had to be a salesman for a concern I once owned. So he had a little resentment. And I suppose if I had to work as a salesman for a business that I had owned, that would not make me happy either. Right? So he's got a little edge going. He says, I had a few words with the boss. The boss probably said, gee, Jim, where were you on Monday anyway? But nothing serious. It says, then I decided to drive into the country and see one of my prospects for a car. On the way, I felt hungry, so I stopped at a roadside place where they have a bar. Listen, underline this. I had no intention of drinking. Right? No intention of drinking. I just thought I would get a sandwich. I also had a notion that I might find a customer for a car at this place, which was familiar, for I had been going to it for years. I had eaten there many times during the months I was sober. I sat down at the table and ordered a sandwich and a glass of milk. Still no thought of drinking. Underline that. No thought of drinking. I ordered another sandwich and decided to have another glass of milk. So far everything's going fine, isn't it? Right? Now here comes this funny italic writing. And everybody circle that first word, suddenly. Because that's exactly how it happens, isn't it? All of a sudden, out of the clear blue sky, I got a great idea. Let's see what Jim's great idea was. Suddenly, the thought, again, all action is born in thought, right? The thought crossed my mind that if I were to put an ounce of whiskey in my milk, it couldn't hurt me after 7 relapses. But that's not what it says, is it? Right? What it says is it couldn't hurt me on a full stomach, right? Now, what did Jim just do? Jim just believed a lie, right? His mind told him a lie, that it was okay to drink whiskey if he mixed it with his milk. It says, I ordered the whiskey and poured it into the milk. I vaguely sensed, everybody circle that. I vaguely sensed I was not being any too smart, but felt reassured that I was taking the whiskey on a full stomach. So Jim's best defense after a trip to the asylum and 7 relapses was he vaguely sensed that he wasn't being too smart. Everybody keep your finger there and turn back to page 24. Middle of the page. The almost certain consequences that follow taking even a glass of beer do not crowd into the mind to deter us. If these thoughts occur, they are hazy and readily supplanted with the old threadbare idea that this time we shall handle ourselves like other people. Back on page 36. Sounds exactly like what happened to Jim, right? These thoughts were vague. They were hazy. It goes on to say in the next sentence on 36, the experiment went so well that I ordered another whiskey and poured it in more milk. That didn't seem to bother me, so I tried another. It goes on to say, this started one more journey to the treatment center for Jim, right? So Jim ran back into the truth, didn't he? Believed a lie, and now he ran into the truth, and the truth was he can't drink normally, right? So he ended up back in the asylum. Here was the threat of commitment, the loss of family and position, to say nothing of that intense mental and physical suffering which drinking always caused him. He had much knowledge about himself as an alcoholic, yet all reasons for drinking were easily pushed aside in favor of the foolish idea that he could take whiskey if only he mixed it with milk. Whatever the precise definition of the word may be, we call this plain insanity. How can such a lack of proportion of the ability to think straight be called anything else? And there's a perfect definition of insanity right there. The lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. Okay? The question is this. Just before I take the first drink, can I see the truth? Right? If I can see the truth just before I take the first drink, then I am sane. If I cannot see the truth, I am insane. Jim could not. Therefore, when it comes to drinking, Jim is insane. Does that make sense to everybody? Okay. Now, is Jim's problem that he has a physical allergy? Or is Jim's real problem that he has a form of insanity that tells him it's okay to take whiskey if he only mixes it with milk? Remember what we found out on page 23. The real problem of the alcoholic centers in the mind, which tells me I can drink, rather than in the body that ensures that I can. Right? All right. It goes on to say, let's jump down to the bottom of page 37. All right. Oh, one other question. I want everybody, this is a little fun experiment I like to do. What is, everybody think about the most insane thing that you ever did while drinking. Got it? Okay, and I would submit to you that the most insane thing that any of us ever did was take the first drink, right? That is the most insane thing I ever did, because I had been proven over and over again that it wasn't going to be possible for me to do that safely. All right, bottom of page 37. They're going to start talking about this nutcase, this jaywalker guy. And I can't relate to this guy. I can't relate to this guy because I don't have his problem, right? I don't have his problem. It says here, our behavior is as absurd and incomprehensible with respect to that first drink as an individual with a passion, say, for jaywalking. He gets a thrill out of skipping in front of fast-moving vehicles. He enjoys himself for a few years in spite of friendly warnings. Up to this point, you would label him as a foolish chap having queer ideas of fun. Luck then deserts him, and he is slightly injured several times in succession. So he's getting he's getting a little older here. He's not as quick as he was, right? So he gets injured a few times, but still nothing serious. It says you would expect him, if you were normal, to cut it out. Presently, he is hit again, and this time he has a fractured skull. So this time he got hurt bad, didn't he? Right? It says, within a week after leaving the hospital, a fast-moving trolley car breaks his arm. He tells you he has decided to stop jaywalking for good, but in a few weeks, he breaks both legs. Right? Now, I don't know what you folks would call this, but this is not social walking. Okay? It says, on through the years, his conduct continues, accompanied by his continual promises to be careful or to keep off the streets altogether. Finally, he can no longer work. His wife gets a divorce and he is held up to ridicule. He tries every known remedy, means to get the jaywalking idea out of his head. He shuts himself in an asylum, hoping to mend his ways, but the day he comes out, he races in front of a fire engine, which breaks his back. Such a man would be crazy, wouldn't he? Absolutely. Okay? Absolutely. But it goes on to say, you may think our illustration is ridiculous, but is it? We who have been through the ringer have to admit, if we substituted alcoholism for jaywalking, the illustration would fit us exactly. However intelligent we may have been in other respects, where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. Everybody highlight that or underline that. Where alcohol has been involved, we have been strangely insane. Okay? They're not talking about clinical insanity here, are they? Right? They're talking about the insane idea that happens just before I drink. Okay? So step two doesn't say we're crazy. It says we have a form of insanity that convinces us it's okay to drink. Okay? That's what they're talking about. All right. Top of page 39. This guy's name is Harry Brick. We call him Fred. His name is Harry Brick. Fred is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. Oh, actually, we're going to jump up the next paragraph up. Excuse me. That may be true of certain non-alcoholic people who, though drinking foolishly and heavily at the present time, are able to stop or moderate because their brains and bodies were not damaged as ours. But with the actual, that's the real alcoholic or potential alcoholic, with hardly an exception, will be absolutely unable to stop drinking on the basis of self-knowledge. Everybody keep your finger there and turn back to page 7. Middle of page 7, Bill's story. It relieved me somewhat to learn that in alcoholics, the will is amazingly weakened when it comes to combating liquor, though it often remains strong in other respects. My incredible behavior in the face of a desperate desire to stop was explained. Understanding myself now, I fared forth with high hope. For 3 or 4 months, the goose hung high. I went to town regularly and even made a little money. Surely this was the answer. Self-knowledge, Bill says. But it was not. For the frightful day came when I drank once more. Right? Back on page 39. I am unable to stop drinking on the basis of step one. There is not enough power in the first step, just knowing that I'm an alcoholic, just knowing that I cannot drink, to keep me sober. How many people here knew that they were an alcoholic and continued to drink? Okay? Most people in this room. Okay? And that's something that the book says they want to smash home upon readers. Now, some people have taken this out of context and they've gotten the idea that, well, knowledge is no good, right? That's not what the book says. The book doesn't say that knowledge is no good. The book says that I am unable to stay sober on the basis of self-knowledge, on the idea that I'm an alcoholic, just knowing that in itself, right? It's like knowing you have cancer, right? You can know you have cancer, right? But until you do something about it, you take some action, until you get the right treatment, it's not going to get you better. Right? All right. Now, by the way, this happens to people who've been sober for a long time. I've personally known people who knew they were alcoholics, who were sober, who got drunk, right? Because they fall victim to a belief that I'm susceptible to, and the belief is this: I'm sober, and I know I'm alcoholic and can't drink, therefore, I'm all right, right? If I know I can't drink, and I know I'm alcoholic and I'm sober today, I must be okay, right? And I stop taking the action necessary to keep me in that recovered state, right? You see, I must continue to take that action. Fred, in the middle of 39, is a well-known is a partner in a well-known accounting firm. His income is good. He has a fine home, is happily married, and the father of promising children of college age. He has so attractive a personality that he makes friends with everyone. If ever there was a successful businessman, it is Fred. To all appearances, he is a stable, well-balanced individual, yet he is an alcoholic. We first saw Fred about a year ago in the hospital where he had gone to recover from a bad case of jitters. It was his first experience of this kind, and he was much ashamed of it. Far from admitting he was an alcoholic, he told himself he had come to the hospital to rest his nerves. And we get a lot of nerve resters in AA, don't we, right? They're not really alcoholics. They're just here to just check it out, right? And that's okay. If you're here resting your nerves today, that's all right. You're welcome. So Jim took step one. Jim knew he was an alcoholic. Fred couldn't even do that, right? Fred couldn't take step one. It says that he was far from admitting he was an alcoholic. The doctor intimated strongly that he might be worse than he realized. For a few days, he was depressed about his condition, and then he made up his mind to quit drinking altogether. It never occurred to him that perhaps he could not do so. In spite of his character and standing, Fred would not believe himself an alcoholic, so he could not accept step one, much less the spiritual remedy. So obviously, if he couldn't take step one, he couldn't take step two. We told him what we knew about alcoholism. Again, that's the second time they've stated that. They did the same thing with Jim, didn't they? They told him about the allergy and the obsession. He was interested and conceded that he had some of the symptoms, but he was a long way from admitting he could do nothing about it himself. He was positive that this humiliating experience plus the knowledge he had acquired would keep him sober for the rest of his life. Self-knowledge, he says, would fix it. We heard no more of Fred for a while. One day, we were told he was back in the treatment center. This time, he was quite shaky. He soon indicated he was very anxious to see us. The story he told is most instructive. Here was a chap absolutely convinced he had to stop drinking, had no excuse for drinking, who exhibited splendid judgment and determination in all his other concerns, yet he was flat on his back nevertheless. Let him tell you about it. Now, once again, like we did with Jim, let's see if we could see where Fred goes from believing the truth to believing a lie, or he goes from sane to insane thinking. It says, I was much impressed with you fellows and what you said about alcoholism, and I frankly did not believe it would be possible for me to drink again. I rather appreciated your ideas about the subtle insanity that precedes the first drink. That was part of what they told him. They told him about the obsession or the insanity that precedes the first drink. But I was confident that it could not happen to me after what I had learned. I reasoned I was not so far advanced as most of you fellows, that I had been unusually successful in licking my other personal problems, that I would therefore succeed where you men had failed. I felt I had every right to be self-confident, that it would only be a matter of exercising my willpower and keeping on my guard. In this frame of mind, I went about my business, and for a time all was well. I had no trouble refusing drinks and began to wonder if I had not been making too hard a work of a simple matter. One day I went to Washington to present some accounting evidence to a government bureau. I had been out of town before during this particular dry spell, so there was nothing new about that. Physically, I felt fine. Now listen to the words he used. Physically, I felt fine. Neither did I have any pressing problems or worries. My business came off well. I was pleased, and I knew my partners would be too. It was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Everything's going great for Fred, right? Fred is doing A-okay. Fred doesn't have a care in the world, right? Now here comes that funny italic writing. I went to the hotel and leisurely dressed for dinner. As I crossed the threshold of the dining room, the thought, again, all action is born in thought, the thought came to mind, that it would be nice to have a couple of cocktails with dinner and go back to the hospital. But that's not what it says, is it? Right? That's what it would say if his mind was telling him the truth. It says, I just want to have a couple of cocktails. What just happened to Fred? He just believed a lie. Right? He just believed a lie. It says, that was all, nothing more. I ordered a cocktail in my meal, then I ordered another cocktail. After dinner, I decided to take a walk. When I returned to the hotel, it struck me that a highball would be fine before going to bed, so I stepped into the bar and had one. I remember having several more that night and plenty the next morning. Then the allergy kicks in, and away he goes, right? It says, I have a shadowy recollection of being in an airplane bound for New York, of finding a friendly taxi cab driver at the landing field instead of my wife. The driver escorted me about for several days. I know little of where I went or what I said and did. Then came the hospital and the unbearable mental and physical suffering. He just ran into the truth, didn't he? Back in the hospital. It says, as soon as I regained my ability to think, I went carefully over that evening in Washington. Not only had I been off guard, I made no fight whatever against the first drink. This time, I had not even thought against the consequences at all. So let's stop right there. So Jim, in our first example, had a vague sense. You remember that? He had a vague sense. Fred didn't have any sense at all, did he? Right? Absolutely no sense. See, I'm a Fred kind of guy, right? I just start drinking. I don't even think about the consequences, right? It says, I commenced to drink as carelessly as though the cocktails were ginger ale. I now remembered what my alcoholic friends had told me, how they prophesized that if I had an alcoholic mind, now he's calling the lie the alcoholic mind, the time and place would come where I would drink again. They said that though I did raise the defense, it would one day give way for some trivial reason for having a drink. Well, just that did happen and more, for what I had learned of alcoholism, step one, did not occur to me at all. I knew from that moment that I had an alcoholic mind. I saw that willpower and self-knowledge would not help me in those strange mental blank spots. Everybody under mental blank spots. I don't know if anybody else here is like that. But there were times during my drinking where I'd drink, and I would want to start drinking because if I thought about it long enough, I'd talk myself out of it. So I would drink before I would let my mind talk me out of it. Anybody here ever done that? Yeah, a few of us. Now, when we talk about these strange mental blank spots, how many people here have been to treatment? Okay, several of us. You know, I've been to treatment, and I love treatment. Don't get me wrong. I think everyone should go to 3 or 4 treatment centers. They're great. I love treatment. And the reason I love treatment is because I can stay sober in treatment. That's why I love treatment, you know. My problem's when I get out of treatment, right? And they're talking about these strange mental blank spots, right? And I'll tell you, a lot of treatment centers, they give you a book or a coin or something, right? And they pass it around, and everybody says something. They say, I know you're going to make it, man. Yeah. Right? And the next day you say, well, Joe was drunk before he hit the corner. You know? What happened? Right? It's exactly what they're talking about right here. These strange mental blank spots that happen, right? That I'm not drinking because I want to. I still have this obsession in the mind that convinces me I've been sober 30 days. This time it's going to be different. Bottom of page 42. They've spent the last 9 pages talking about what won't work, haven't they? They've spent the last 9 pages telling us why self-knowledge won't work, why, believing that I'm an alcoholic won't work, et cetera, et cetera. And now they're going to bring us right back to the solution we talked about in chapter 2. Okay? They're going to bring us right back to that. Okay? Before I get to that, though, I want to say one more thing. Turn back to page 41 for a second. Top of page 41, you'll remember they talked about Fred. He says he felt fine. He didn't have any pressing problems or worries. End of a perfect day. Anybody here ever heard of HALT? Don't get too hungry, angry, lonely, or tired. Y'all heard that, right? Okay. Was this guy hungry? Was he angry? Was he lonely? Was he tired? No. You see, I have a spiritual malady. And my spiritual malady cannot be treated with physical means. Okay? You see, how many people here drank when they were hungry? How many people drank when they were full? How many people drank when they were angry? How many people drank when they weren't? Okay, my point I'm trying to make here is I cannot predict when the obsession will come back. You see? So I must treat my spiritual malady with a spiritual remedy, right? And I've heard all sorts of people, I'm working out more, right? I'm drinking prune juice. I'm doing this. I'm doing that. I got this great girlfriend, right? Guys I sponsor always have a great girlfriend, right? And that works for a while, right? But sooner or later, and for those of you who are new, you're just going to have to trust me on this, okay? You reach a point in sobriety where you can't put anything between you and you, right? And you've got to either get a spiritual remedy to your solution or you're going to drink, right? And I've been there. I've been there. All right, bottom of page 42. They outline the spiritual answer, step two, and the program of action, which 100 of them had followed successfully, right? You remember back in Bill's story when Ebby came to visit him in his kitchen? Ebby told him of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. Sounds like the same thing they're telling old Fred here, doesn't it? Right? It says, though I had only been a nominal churchman, their proposals were not intellectually hard to swallow. But the program of action, though entirely sensible, was pretty drastic. Everybody underline this next sentence. It meant I would have to throw several lifelong conceptions out the window. What does that mean? It means some of what I know has to change, right? It has to change, right? Keep your finger right there and turn to page 27. Which also means if some of what I know has to change, it means that some of what I know is wrong, right? And I don't like that. See? I like being right, right? I like being right. Page 27, second paragraph, about six lines down. To me, these occurrences are phenomena. They appear to be in the nature of huge emotional displacements and rearrangements. Ideas, emotions, and attitudes which were once the guiding forces of the lives of these men are suddenly cast to one side and a completely new set of conceptions and motives begin to dominate them. I think they're talking about change. Let's turn to page 58. Bottom of the page, jump up three lines. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil till we let go absolutely. Let's turn to page 143. First paragraph. If your man accepts your offer, it should be pointed out that physical treatment, halt, is but a small part of the big picture. A small part. Though you are providing him with the best possible medical attention, he should understand that he must undergo a change of heart. To get over drinking will require a transformation of thought and attitude. Now listen to this. This is kind of off the subject, but listen to this next sentence. We all had to place recovery above everything. I wonder how important that is. Right? My experience is anything I put between me and recovery, I will lose it, and then I will lose my sobriety, right? I have to put my sobriety ahead of everything, right? All right, back on page, where were we? 43. Lost my place. All right. Now they're going to take us back to our solution, and they're going to tell us three times. Remember back on page 24, it told us that we are without a defense against the first drink? Last week we talked about that, that at certain times I have no effective mental defense. I'm without a defense. They're going to tell me three times on this page where my defense is going to come from, right? And we're actually going to start at the bottom of page 42. Quite as important was the discovery that spiritual principles would solve all my problems, not just my alcohol problem. That's not what this is about. Somehow we've gotten this idea that Alcoholics Anonymous is a non-drinking program, right? And that's not what the book says. The book says that Alcoholics Anonymous is a life-changing program, right? A way of life, a manner of living, a way of living, a design for living, it calls it. It says, I have since been brought into a way of living infinitely more satisfying and I hope more useful than the one I lived before. My old manner of life was by no means a bad one, but I would not exchange its best moments for the worst I have now. I would not go back, even though I could. Fred's story speaks for itself. We hope it strikes home to thousands like him. He had only felt the first nip of the ringer. Most alcoholics have to be pretty badly mangled before they commence to solve their problems. Many doctors and psychiatrists agree with our conclusions. One of these men, staff member at a world-renowned hospital, recently made this statement to some of us. What you say about the general hopelessness of the average alcoholic's plight is, in my opinion, correct. As the two of you men whose stories I have heard, there is no doubt in my mind that you were 100% hopeless apart from divine help. That's the first time. I am hopeless apart from divine help. Had you offered yourself as patients at this hospital, I would not have taken you if I'd been able to avoid it. People like you are too heartbreaking. Though not a religious person, I have a profound respect for the spiritual approach in cases such as yours. Listen to this. For most cases, there is virtually no other solution. And now he's going to sum up what we talked about last week in chapter 2 and bring us right back to this common solution, this idea of a spiritual experience. It says, once more, the alcoholic, and that's the real alcoholic, at certain times, everybody circle that, we're going to come back to that, at certain times has no effective mental defense against the first drink. And they're actually paraphrasing what they're going to tell us again on page 60. A, that I'm alcoholic and cannot manage my own life. Right? It means the same thing. Except in a few rare cases, neither he nor any other human being can provide such a defense. B, that probably no human power could have relieved their alcoholism. His defense must come from a higher power. C, that God couldn't would if he were sought. Right? He's going to tell us the same thing when we get to page 60. So my defense must come from a higher power. Right? And it says at certain times, not all the time, right? But if I'm having a bad spiritual bad hair day, okay? If I get a little resentment, if I get a little anxiety, or if especially when I'm right, right? And I like to be right, okay? But if you get me right long enough, I'll tell you something. I can reach a point where the consequences of that drink become insignificant. And I will reach for the solution. You see, because what I can do that doesn't happen to the non-alcoholic is I can literally induce a temporary psychic change with a few drinks, right? And that's what happens to a guy like me when I take a drink. Now, if my solution is a spiritual experience, and I have to have this spiritual experience in order to recover, then I'm going to need to have some sort of a relationship with God, right? And Bill knows he's only got 17 more pages before he's going to ask us to make a decision in step 3. And thank God he knew that there were going to be thousands and thousands of alcoholics just like me who were going to have to get some new ideas about God in order to be able to make that decision, right? And so thankfully for me, he put an entire chapter in this book devoted to entirely that. It's called We Agnostics, and we're going to talk about that starting next week. That's it for today. Thank you.